The fluorescent lights in the open plan office didn't just illuminate the desks. They felt like they were vibrating against my skull, a low-frequency hum that matched the steady thrum of anxiety in my chest. It was 9:42 p.m. on a Tuesday, and the only other soul in the building was Marcus, whose office door was a sliver of warm, expensive amber light at the end of the sterile white hallway. I wasn't there because of a deadline or a crisis in the logistics chain. I was there because Marcus liked the energy of a dedicated team, which in his vocabulary was a code for women who didn't have anywhere else to be. He called it a retention bonus, a term that sounded professional and clinical, until you realize the criteria for retention had nothing to do with your performance metrics and everything to do with how long you could endure his proximity after the cleaning crew had already finished the third floor. I sat there, my fingers hovering over a keyboard I wasn't even using anymore, listening to the silence of a building that should have been empty. Every time I heard his mahogany chair creak, my posture stiffened. He'd come out eventually, usually with a glass of scotch that smelled like peat and entitlement, leaning against my cubicle wall to talk about vision and loyalty. The first time, the extra $4,000 hit my account. I thought it was a clerical error, a glitch in the payroll software that would surely be clawed back by morning. Then came the email from Marcus, marked private, stating that he appreciated my commitment to the firm's long-term stability and that this discretionary retention incentive was his way of ensuring the right talent stayed in the room. I was 28, drowning in student loans and the skyrocketing rent of a city that didn't care if I lived or died, so I didn't ask questions. I just stayed later. The pattern didn't reveal itself in a grand explosion. It bled out in whispers in the communal kitchen and the quiet, frantic exchanges in the parking garage. It started when Sarah, a senior analyst who worked three desks down, mentioned she'd finally put a down payment on a condo. We were both white, both mid-career, both trapped in the same cycle of performing availability for a man who treated the office like his personal living room. We compared notes over lukewarm coffee, the realization dawning on us like a cold front moving in. The men in the department, the guys who left at 5:30 p.m. to go to the gym or see their kids, weren't getting these emails. The women who had families and left on time weren't getting them either. It was a tax on our time, a bribe for our silence, and a leash made of direct deposits. Marcus wasn't just paying us for our work. He was buying a specific type of atmospheric compliance. He wanted an audience for his late-night monologues, a gallery of professional women who would nod at his brilliance while the rest of the world slept. By the time the third bonus hit, the atmosphere in the office had shifted from professional collaboration to a guarded, twitchy suspicion. We were a sorority of the exhausted, tied together by a secret ledger that felt increasingly like a confession. I watched Marcus walk the floor during the day, his hand lingering just a second too long on a shoulder, his comments about dedication carrying a weight that made my skin crawl. He was building a wall of financial dependence, knowing that once we adjusted our lifestyles to include that extra $5,000 or $10,000 a quarter, the thought of losing it would be more terrifying than the thought of staying until midnight to hear about his divorce or his theories on market disruption. The collapse happened during the Q3 audit. Someone in HR, a woman who clearly hadn't been invited into the retention circle, flagged the discrepancy. It wasn't just the amount. It was the demographic. A spreadsheet appeared on a leaked internal server, a digital map of Marcus's preferences. It was a sea of names, all female, all with the same irregular high-value deposits, labeled under a code that didn't exist in the official employee handbook. The men in the office went ballistic. They didn't see the predatory nature of the payments. They saw a missed opportunity for profit. They saw unfair advantages and gender-based favoritism. The irony was a bitter pill that stuck in my throat every time I passed the break room and heard them complaining about how they were being discriminated against for having lives outside the office. Marcus didn't panic. Men like Marcus have a built-in survival instinct that allows them to flip the script before the ink on the accusation is even dry. He called an all-hands meeting in the glass-walled conference room, the space smelling of expensive upholstery and the collective sweat of 60 panicked employees. He stood at the head of the table, looking disappointed, like a father whose children had failed a simple test of character. He didn't deny the bonuses. Instead, he framed them as a response to our unrelenting requests for recognition. He looked directly at me, his eyes cold and devoid of the feigned warmth of our late-night sessions, and told the entire room that he had felt pressured to provide these incentives because we, the women, had made it clear that our extra effort required extraordinary compensation. He shifted the entire weight of the scandal onto our shoulders. He told the board and the disgruntled male colleagues that he was simply trying to navigate the complexities of modern workplace demands, and that we had been the ones to set the price for our presence. The retention label was now a weapon. He claimed we had used the threat of leaving to extract these funds from him, painting himself as the victim of a coordinated female shakedown. I watched Sarah's face turn a ghostly shade of gray as Marcus explained that he had regrettably succumbed to the culture of entitlement we had fostered. He didn't mention the way he'd ghosted our emails during the day, only to demand meetings at 9 p.m. He didn't mention the comments about how lonely the executive wing got after hours. He just talked about the money. The aftermath was a slow-motion car crash of reputation and resentment. The men who had been our friends now looked at us with a sneering distrust, convinced we'd been running a scam under their noses. The women who hadn't received the bonuses looked at us with a different kind of anger, a sense of betrayal that we'd participated in a system that excluded them. Marcus, meanwhile, was disciplined with a slap on the wrist and a temporary freeze on his own bonus structure. But he kept his chair. He kept his amber-lit office. We were the ones left holding the bill for a crime he designed. I went back to my desk that evening, the habit of staying late still etched into my bones like a phantom limb. The office was quiet, but the silence wasn't peaceful anymore. It was heavy with the realization that I had sold my dignity for a retention bonus that was designed to make me unhirable anywhere else. If I left now, I was the woman who accepted bribes. If I stayed, I was the woman who was retained by a predator. I looked at the clock, 6:14 p.m. For the first time in 2 years, I stood up, grabbed my bag, and walked toward the elevator. As the doors began to slide shut, I saw Marcus emerge from his office. He didn't say a word. He just stood there, glass of scotch in hand, watching me leave with a look of smug satisfaction. He knew that the money was already spent. He knew that the bridge behind me was in flames. He had paid for my destruction and labeled it an investment in my future. And as the elevator descended, the only thing I could feel was the weight of the gold-plated handcuffs tightening around my wrists. I wasn't being retained. I was being buried. And I had handed him the shovel the moment I thanked him for the first check. The realization that he would do this again to the next girl, and the one after her, hit me with the force of a physical blow. The system wasn't broken. It was working exactly as Marcus had intended, turning our survival instincts into the very evidence used to condemn us.